The Rethink Food in America movement actually started with Michelle Obama. That was her platform.
Oh. I don't think that went well, did it?
It actually didn't. And that's when Congress declared that pizza was a vegetable. It was like their protest.
I heard that on a podcast. I've never podcasted before. Have you podcasted before?
I've never podcasted before.
I've never even been a guest on a podcast. Welcome to another episode of Rolling Forward,
the podcast where we help you keep your children healthy in these changing times.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
I'm a psychiatrist.
And I'm a pediatrician.
I'm a researcher, as is Alicia.
And we're sisters.
I'm older.
And I'm taller.
But sometimes in photos, it looks like I'm taller.
It never looks like you're taller in photos.
Okay, fine. We want to give people the fact-based info that they need to keep kiddos in their life safe, even if I am not actually taller.
The fact is that you are 5 years older and 5 inches shorter.
Oh my gosh, you're just like putting me on blast right now.
These are the facts.
We'll go behind the headlines, cut through the noise, and explain the real science you can trust.
So whether you want to rewind something, like Alicia saying that I was shorter, or you want to pause a conversation with your family member on Facebook, or you just want to fast forward to the action playlist, we got you. This week, we want to talk about a topic that we've been hearing so much about.
And that topic is the Department of Health and Human Services.
This week, Trump said that he wanted to put Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in charge of Health and Human Services, also known as HHS. And that caused a lot of headlines and a lot of news as people tried to figure out what that would mean. We just want to start by giving you the facts about what HHS is and how it affects you and your life. How HHS operates, it's that it's made up of more than a dozen different agencies. We have at various points in time worked alongside the CDC. We've been funded by the NIH, and so we've had interactions professionally with these different parts of HHS, but sometimes it can be hard to get the scope of what HHS is, so we just thought that we would start there.
The Department of Health and Human Services is a part of the federal executive branch. It has a budget of over $1.5 trillion every single year, and its mission is to, quote, enhance the health and well-being of Americans.
$1.5 trillion is so much. I'm just trying to imagine how many zeros that is.
More than I can count. It's definitely more than I can count. And that's per year. So if you think about it over a four-year administration, right, we're talking about $6 trillion.
Let's first start by talking about the CDC.
Let's talk about the CDC. It's not the biggest branch, but it is an important branch.
That's true. What's so important about the CDC, Alicia?
So the CDC stands for the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, and it is housed or is based down in Atlanta, Georgia. Both of us have actually previously worked for the CDC at some point or other. And the CDC is an agency that's designed to, quote, save lives and protect people from human threats. It is a public health institute, and their role is to kind of respond to emerging health threats, whether that's infectious disease or foodborne pathogens, as well as kind of chronic disease.
That's right. And I used to work alongside the CDC in Alaska, where there's an outpost there that tracks outbreaks and diseases that are especially affecting the Alaska Native community. And in that role, we would at times fly out into small villages because we were tracking different health concerns. In doing this, the CDC is playing a really important role in understanding and recognizing health threats as they're first emerging.
They had a very large role. I think it became a lot more commonplace to talk about the CDC during the COVID-19 pandemic, following the spread of infectious disease. They're also kind of frequently in the news when we're following foodborne pathogens. Just today, they released the statement about the E. coli outbreak in carrots, and they're recalling carrots from certain places. So they really follow, they do a large role on following outbreaks of disease. But they also have this focus on environmental health, occupational safety and health, injury prevention and health promotion. I actually worked at CDC in kind of this realm, working for the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, which kind of falls sort of under the CDC. It's housed in the same building. And they also have this large focus on leading causes of death and disability in the United States, including chronic disease and other kind of major health threats that we're seeing in our population. And so recently, actually, they've done a lot of work in preventing opiate overdoses in America.
overdose deaths have dropped nearly 15% in the United States since June of 23.
That's a huge decrease when you think about it. 15% since June 2023, which wasn't even that long ago. And when you kind of calculate the number of lives saved, they estimate that about 15,000 lives have been saved that otherwise would have died without some of these interventions. And so the role of the CDC has been huge in our day-to-day life. We've seen it with COVID, we see it with our foodborne outbreaks, and we've seen it kind of subtly in some of the new policies on overcoming substance use disorders in the United States.
So that's the CDC in a nutshell. And the CDC has so many different programs. Again, it on its own could have its own podcast, and they've really made remarkable progress in the past few years in terms of tackling and reducing opioid overdose deaths.
So I like to think about the CDC as the Public Health Institute. They're the ones that make us wear helmets and wear seatbelts. And I like to think of NIH as our biomedical research institute. So let's talk about the NIH next.
That's right. The NIH, or the National Institutes of Health, this is one of the largest agencies of HHS, and its mission is to advance scientific knowledge. And they have been doing that.
So they fund medical research in the United States, and they do that in kind of two separate ways. The first is that they have a campus here in, just outside of DC, actually, in Bethesda, and some smaller campuses throughout the United States that fund their own kind of researchers. And that is called intramural research when you work directly for NIH. The intramural branch of the NIH is the largest biomedical research institute in the world.
That's true.
So they are a huge organization that does a lot of research in their own labs.
And then most of the NIH budget, about 90%, is actually what they call the extramural research program. And this is going to researchers at other places, many at universities throughout the country or even beyond that. And that grant goes through extensive review, vetting, and if it gets funded, then that grant becomes reality. And this is where most of the NIH budget comes from. And this is actually how most medical research happens. The NIH has so much money to fund medical research that they are really driving what scientific knowledge is being learned in medical research in America.
So not only are they the largest biomedical research institute through their intramural program, they're the largest public funder of biomedical research in the world through their extramural program. And they're funding people like you and me. So we're both NIH-funded researchers, and we have grants through different mechanisms. And so I'm currently funded by NIAID, which is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. This is the previous home of Dr. Fauci, and so I think it is very famous. And you're funded through the NIMH, which is the National Institute of Mental Health. So the NIH grants not only pay for the research and the supplies and your research team, they pay for your salary support to protect your time from doing clinical work. So instead of doing four shifts a month in the emergency department, I can spend that time advancing research, advancing science.
That's right. And this is not pharma industry sponsored research. These are people who are doing research at academic universities and networks throughout the country and throughout the world, really trying to advance scientific knowledge and contributing to what we know. And it has been successful. There are 153 scientists who have received financial support from the NIH and then gone on to win a Nobel Prize. And there will surely be more in the coming years and decades.
The NIH is really at the forefront of biomedical research and are coming out with new medical devices, new technologies, new surgical procedures, new medications, new kind of behavioral interventions for all sorts of diseases. I think they have 27 separate institutes within their overall NIH, and each of them are kind of focused on many different diseases and processes. And so it's amazing of all the work that is coming out of the NIH.
And just to try to spotlight one area a little, there are so many parts that the NIH is doing wonderful work that we could highlight, but to try to spotlight one area, it is estimated that 1 in 5 Americans will have cancer in their lifetime. So it's possible that there's someone in your family, in your network that you know that has gone through this recently. And according to the American Cancer Society, they believe that over 4 million lives have been saved in the past 30 years because of these improvements in cancer treatment, detection, and prevention.
Created by the NIH.
True.
Specifically from the NIH. And if you're a math person, that's about a 33% drop in the rates of cancer deaths since 1991.
Which is huge that someone can be diagnosed with cancer and then have access to these early detection, treatment, and prevention strategies. It's really changing people's lives and changing people's families. And we say that as people who we've experienced cancer within our own family. Family members of ours who have been really helped by these research developments.
And you can see a lot of the work that is coming out of the NIH with all new sorts of monoclonal antibodies and other kind of gene therapies and more kind of specific complicated chemotherapies. As a resident, I was seeing them on the floor as they were becoming more commercially available. So you're seeing lots of changes in the way that we practice healthcare coming directly out of the NIH.
They've really been out there in their own way. And so NIH, totally part of our everyday lives, even though we may not realize it. Pivoting to another institute that has been in the news a lot lately. You ready to talk about the FDA?
The FDA. So that's the Food and Drug Administration.
So tell me, what does the FDA do?
Shockingly, just like all the other institutes that we've talked about, they're responsible for protecting the public health. And they do that by ensuring the safety, efficacy, and security of drugs and medical devices and ensuring the safety of our nation's own food supply.
Let's talk about drugs first. So there were 55 new drugs approved by the FDA in 2023. And it sounds like about half of these were to prevent, diagnose, or treat a rare disease or condition, which means that this is a type of illness that doesn't affect a lot of people. And so it doesn't necessarily have a huge market to sell the drugs to, but that it's critically important.
If they go through extensive testing process, they go through 4 to 5 stages of clinical trials before a drug is approved. And that approval process is lengthy. It looks at side effects. It looks at efficacy. And it takes many, many, many years to go through that process. 55 drugs might not sound huge, but those are 55 new medications where there is no kind of similar medication on the market, in addition to the generic medications and the new bioequivalents that become released or approved every year. So it's 55 new medications on top of all the other kind of bioequivalent medications that are being approved.
And then in addition to that, the FDA regulates our nation's food supplies. They decide what goes into food, what's safe to be in food. Our family's from Belgium. We've immigrated here. And there are certain food items that we know and love, and they taste different here than they do in Belgium.
Oreos taste disgusting in Canada.
Oh, right. And then we lived in Canada, and Oreos taste so different in Canada.
They're disgusting. They're not Oreos.
Alicia says disgusting. I say different.
Disgusting.
But the cheese in Canada is really good.
But the Oreos are disgusting.
So you have to make your bet, cheese or Oreos. But let's talk about something that the FDA did in 2023, which was really big.
So something that's huge in pediatrics is RSV. And if you have a young child, that's probably an acronym that you've heard a lot.
RSV is respiratory syncytial virus.
It is a cause of a common cold that if you or I were to get, we would get the sniffles. But in young children, particularly children under 12 months, it can be particularly serious and it can lead to severe lower respiratory tract infection.
So as the mom of a toddler, I spent the past 2 winters really worried about RSV and calling Alicia every time my daughter was coughing. And I have a stethoscope. I can listen to her lungs. I am fully capable of doing this. And yet there's something about the reassurance of Alicia that I just would just call her and ask her to come over here and listen to my daughter's lungs.
So RSV can cause severe lower respiratory tract infection disease in toddlers. And what that means is that they have a hard time breathing and a hard time getting oxygen to their body. And it can be really dangerous. RSV is one of the largest causes of hospitalization in children. The rate is so high that in comparison, it's about 10 times the rate of hospitalization for influenza or the flu.
When I lived in Alaska, this was a major concern about the young children living there, the high rates of RSV and RSV-related hospitalizations. And when my daughter was born, it's something that we really worried about. She was born in winter, in January, and we spent the first few months really trying to protect her from RSV because she was so little that an infection like that could really be devastating. Last year, so at the same time in right around the same time in 2023, the FDA approved 2 new treatments for RSV, which is
It was huge. One was a vaccine for pregnant women who could receive it prior to giving birth so that they would be able to pass on immunity to their newborn. And their newborn would now be born with protection to RSV.
Which is huge.
And then the second is a preventative antibody, something called a monoclonal antibody, that can be given to kids themselves, and it helps bolster their immune system by giving them the antibody directly and protects them from RSV. And my daughter just missed the cutoff for that monoclonal antibody treatment by one day. And we really tried to get it for her, but weren't able to. But many, many of her friends did receive it. And we saw such a decline in RSV.
So as an emergency medicine physician, RSV is my bread and butter in the winter. And it really drives up our population. And the clinical trials of Beyfortus were simply incredible. So it was a 5-stage trial. And in some of the stages, they were showing reduction of lower respiratory tract infection by about 75% in infants that had received this new medication.
We're here in DC, and I looked up the weekly hospitalization rates for RSV in DC, and it decreased by more than 20% last winter when these new treatments were introduced compared to the winter before. It's really interesting that it decreased hospitalizations that much. I also think that it means we can redirect resources towards other public health concerns, which is huge. So if you're the parent of a young child out there and you haven't heard of these treatments, it's a great thing to ask your pediatrician about. They've really been a game changer for young kids and their families. So that is the CDC, the public health, the NIH, the research arm, the FDA, getting new treatments out there and approved, making sure they're safe before they enter. And now we just wanted to highlight one more agency. There's so many more agencies we can highlight, but there's one more agency that we wanted to highlight because we think they're pretty cool.
It's the U.S. Public Health Service.
And their mission, drumroll, shocking, is to protect the health of an entire population. And what's really cool about the Public Health Service is that the people who work there, essentially many of them by day have other jobs within HHS. Maybe they're a medical officer for the CDC. Maybe they're a nurse who analyzes data for the FDA. And yet, then when there is a public health emergency, they are deployed to serve and to offer immediate support to people who are experiencing that emergency.
So the U.S. Public Health Service is led by the Surgeon General.
Who is so cool. I always thought the Surgeon General was the coolest job for a physician to have ever.
I think the most famous Surgeon General is Surgeon General Koop.
Yes.
Who really tackled smoking and nicotine. And the Surgeon General warning on the cigarettes comes from Surgeon General Koop.
And then the Public Health Service is deployed to respond to emergencies. So one recent public health emergency that the Public Health Service responded to was the health needs of people in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee following Hurricane Helene. So a public health emergency was declared following that, and hundreds of Public Health Service officers were sent to that region in order to provide on-the-ground assistance and help.
It's not always the most glamorous of jobs. Public health service officers will sleep on the floors of gymnasiums and schools and
wherever you can find a space.
And you work really long hours and you pack in, pack out oftentimes a lot of your food with you. You live off Easy Mac and microwavable food for a month. We have both kind of been in this experience before. And you spend all day kind of identifying which populations are vulnerable and which populations have the highest needs and kind of tailoring treatment to what people need. And that can be things like finding out who needs home oxygen tanks or who needs dialysis in the setting of a space that has been ravaged by a hurricane, and kind of connecting people with the resources they need.
As everything was happening during Hurricane Helene, maybe the first thing on your mind wasn't who needs dialysis and how do we connect them to that. If someone's kidneys aren't working, they can have a machine essentially serve the role of the kidneys and remove toxins from their blood. But you can't go more than a few days without dialysis. And so it really was an urgent health need, and Public Health Service was there for that.
I just want to go back for a second. We briefly covered a couple of the kind of large, most well-known players of the Department of Health and Human Services. But to say that this is not an extensive review at all, we haven't actually covered the two large largest of the Department of Health and Human Services, which includes CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid Services, and the Administration for Children and Families, which like provides WIC and foster care and welfare and all of those things. And so we didn't talk about Indian Health Services or HRSA. So the Department of Health and Human Services is huge. We covered a small snapshot of a small snippet, and there are just astronomical impacts on your day-to-day life that you don't even realize or know.
This is just a snapshot of what HHS does for people in America. And the news this week was that it seems like RFK Jr. has been nominated to lead that. And if that nomination passes successfully, he will be leading this organization. It means he would have a leadership role directing the actions of the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, the Public Health Service, and all of these other parts of the agency. And it caused concern because some of his prior statements about health.
When we talk about RFK Jr., I think there is a lot of rhetoric on the internet. There are a lot of comments that he's made. There's a lot of thoughts about his comments. I think RFK Jr. is a really complicated person to understand and a really complicated to understand his policies, particularly because a snippet of what he says is true and very, like, very reasonable. And then a lot of the information that he uses to support that is not, and it has a lot of misinformation. And so when you kind of listen to small clips, you're like, oh yeah, that really makes sense. And I think that is actually what makes it so complicated, is that it can sometimes be hard to tell fact from fiction because he is using misinformation to support factual claims.
I mean, there's some things that he says that when you hear them, you're like,
okay. Yeah. I agree. Things like food is medicine. Like, yes, we like should be able to prescribe gym memberships for patients with diabetes, and that like what you eat does change your health outcomes. But then when he follows that with you should drink raw milk because food is medicine, then I have a little bit more concerns, and we can go into some of these into more detail in the future.
Absolutely.
So his background comes in environmental law. And so he's very concerned about environmental toxins in a way that makes sense and in a way that doesn't make sense. He talks about the problems of chronic disease in America, and we have shown a huge rise in chronic disease in America. He talks about the concerns about toxins in the water.
So one of the things RFK Jr. has been very vocal about is his plan to remove fluoride from the water. He has stated on multiple occasions that fluoride is considered quite dangerous, and has made this argument that if a large vat of fluoride were to spill into the environment, that it would be very toxic and very hazardous and dangerous from human health. Daphne, can you tell me a little bit more about that and why that argument maybe isn't quite the way that it seems?
There is chemicals in the water that are dangerous to children that we need to get out, and that is lead. And Alicia trained in Michigan, so she knows this very well. There is a public health crisis in Flint, Michigan, where lead does need to be removed from the water. And that is where the energy and attention should be going, not to fluoride.
So if you were to walk into a room that had 100% oxygen, you would die, right? The air that we breathe has 21% oxygen. If you get too much oxygen, that will kill you.
It's all about concentration and how much you're getting. You need oxygen to live, but you cannot live with 100% oxygen in the air. That there needs to, you also cannot live with 0% oxygen in the air. Either of those is very dangerous for you. That doesn't mean oxygen is dangerous, that we should remove it from the environment.
He struggles with understanding the science behind some of the points that he's making, and then he conflates different things together, and he confuses correlation and causation. And so a lot of the meat of his points are not entirely factual and not actually truthful or based in science, in fact. RFK Jr. has a very interesting history with vaccines, where he has been both quoted as an anti-vaxxer and a pro-vaxxer. He claims that he's not anti-vaxxer because his children are vaccinated, but has a very long history of kind of saying some anti-vaccine rhetoric that is not shown to be truthful in the literature.
He is coming into this position where he's going to lead all of these health agencies. And a concern about him and vaccines is a very tragic event happened in 2018 in Samoa.
A measles vaccine was given in Samoa, and the measles vaccine needs to be mixed. It's a powder, and it needs to be mixed with liquid in order to be given. And unfortunately, tragically, it was mixed with a muscle relaxant instead of the normal like saline that it was supposed to be mixed with, and two children in Samoa died. So it's the muscle relaxant part that was quite dangerous, despite the fact that the measles vaccine has been proven time and time again to be very efficacious and very safe.
And this was such a tragic event. And as you might understand, when headlines come out that two infants died after receiving a measles vaccine, people become scared. Rates of vaccination started to decrease in Samoa, and enter RFK Jr.
In 2019, RFK Jr. actually visits Samoa, and he uses these two unfortunate tragic deaths to raise questions about the safety of vaccines and meets with officials all across the country. The vaccination rate decreases from about 60 to 70% to about 30% over the next few months. And within 4 months, there is a new outbreak of measles that affect nearly 6,000 people in Samoa. He was later quoted to say that the outbreak in Samoa was, quote, mild.
Yeah, there was just a huge uptick in the number of deaths after he went there. Funeral homes were running out of children's coffins. It's heartbreaking. This is why it raises concern that he's about to take over, if confirmed, all these health agencies. To take an event like what happened in Samoa, which was a mistake, it was a tragedy, it wasn't related to vaccines, and to come in and really push the anti-vax sentiment leading to this outbreak and deaths of all these children and say, it's mild afterwards. This is what makes it concerning that he may be taking over HHS.
There has been discussion about whether or not certain vaccines are going to be pulled, despite lots of scientific evidence saying that they're effective and safe. There's concern about pulling funding from schools that mandate vaccinations. And so the future of vaccinations in the U.S., I think, is in question.
So that is a reason that we as physicians, me as a mom, you as an auntie, that we're concerned.
I can just say that, like, as a pediatrician, I think vaccines is something that I see in the day to day. And as an emergency physician, I think emergency physicians are terrified about what the future looks like. We've already seen this 20% uptake in measles outbreaks in the past year. I've seen more cases of chickenpox in the past year than I have in my career. And so there are concerns about really serious infectious diseases coming back with decrease of vaccinations.
I mean, the measles vaccinations have been so successful that so many doctors have gone their entire career without seeing a case. And now I'm continually getting public health notices telling me what the signs and symptoms of measles are so that I can recognize it when someone comes in.
Just last winter, we were traveling, and then we got notified by the Department of Health that we were at the airport at the same time that someone with measles had been at the airport. And it was a notice being like, we might have been exposed to measles. I think final thoughts about the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a huge, widespread, multifaceted agency that affects way more than you think of your day-to-day life. And impacts can be profound. I think changes can be profound. And it's very unclear what HHS will look like in 6 months from now. I think it's unclear. Under the Trump administration in 2016, the focus was on CDC. And so the NIH, despite Trump making claims every year that he wanted to cut the budget of NIH, there was a lot of bipartisan support, and the NIH budget actually increased every single year under the Trump administration from 2016.
I didn't know that, but that makes sense.
It's true. So while Trump said that he wanted to cut the budget significantly of the NIH during his previous presidency, there was a lot of bipartisan support for medical research, especially in the setting of the pandemic. And so the NIH budget actually grew significantly all 4 years.
But it did feel like they involved themselves in some of the inner workings of the CDC.
So I actually think what was really interesting about that presidency is that the CDC was the target, I think, of the director of the Health and Human Services at the time. And the CDC changed as an institution during that administration. And I think it's interesting to see that the oncoming targets, I think, of this administration seem to be, from preliminary statements, the NIH and the FDA. And it'll be interesting to see how much congressional support the new president has. It'll be interesting to see how much congressional support biomedical research has, because cancer is something that affects everybody.
Yeah, I think that's where we can expect to see a lot of changes, and we will unpack them here with you.
We wanted to end this episode by giving people some concrete ways to look for and to identify any health misinformation or disinformation that can be coming your way. And the reason for that is, while RFK Jr. has made some points that people agree with, he's had a pretty concerning pattern of behavior in terms of the statements that he's made about fluoride, about vaccines, and it's alarmed people who work in public health, people who work in medicine. We want to end by giving some pointers on when something that you're hearing might not really gel.
We're just going to give you some tips on how to identify what is kind of misinformation and what is reliable information, and how you can tell the difference between these.
So our first point is to think about extremes, that if there's a statement that is all or none, black or white, it's worth just taking a pause and thinking about, because science is usually more nuanced than that.
Our second point was to identify the source of the information and how trustworthy the source might be. And then understanding that there's a difference between correlation and causation. Just because two things might be happening at the same time doesn't mean that necessarily that one is causing the other.
Absolutely. And so just keep those in mind as you're getting all of these health news, everything going to you. And it's something that we hope will help you navigate some of the conflicting health messages coming your way.
So that's it for this week. We are rolling forward. We're a new podcast and we're providing science-based parenting advice that you need.
Please like and follow us or subscribe to our podcast.
You can also send us your questions at rollingforwardshow@gmail.com. That's rollingforwardshow@gmail.com. We are on X, Instagram. We are going to Blue Sky. We are trying to figure out how to do this. We are on TikTok.
I didn't know that.
We are on TikTok. I don't think we have any videos yet, but stay tuned. We'll make one.